Thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, Session 155, titled Self-Compassion, Bringing Healing and Growth to Your Faith Journey. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning the end of August 2020. There will be Q&A, and the presenters will be answering questions also maybe throughout the presentation, so please type them into the Whova app to be addressed. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There's more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given a space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing to at sunstone.org. About this presentation, having compassion for yourself means honoring and accepting the messiness of your own human experience. This messiness is often painfully present as our faith evolves. In this session, we will explore how to integrate the practice of self-compassion when challenging experiences arise, through discussion, meditation, and experimental exercises, we will learn how to treat ourselves with greater care, kindness, and understanding. I'll take a second to introduce you to our speakers before we begin. Janice Bangler is a graduate of the University of Utah, Integral Coaching Canada, and the Living School. She works as an integral professional life coach with Symmetry Solutions, specializing in coaching individuals, couples, and families affected by difficulties of shifting faith. She is a frequent guest on other Mormon-themed podcasts, a speaker at conferences, workshops, firesides, retreats, and a guest lecturer at BYU on issues of faith and development. Diane Rain Jones is a trained, mindful, self-compassion teacher offering workshops and courses in the Austin area. She also works as a facilitator for Girls Empowerment Network and Girls with Grit, nonprofits focused on equity through education. She attended the Mystic Heart Wisdom School, a spiritual formation program exploring the mystic heart of the world's religions, and recently completed an interfaith spiritual direction certification. I will now give the floor to our presenters.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen with everyone. Okay, well, we're so happy you've joined us today. And I know I'm thrilled to be talking about one of my favorite topics of all time, which is self-compassion. And to start, we just wanted to share a little bit about what brought us to self-compassion, why we are so passionate about it. So I'll start. The story often goes, I became a teacher of self-compassion because I have just found it to be such a meaningful practice in my own life. And I was introduced to it about 5 years ago. I had gotten involved in meditation and was volunteering at a local meditation center near where we lived in San Francisco. And so I would look through the catalog and find things I was interested in. And I saw that Kristen Neff was coming. And so I thought, oh yeah, I want to volunteer for that and find out more about self-compassion. I don't know anything about it, but it sounds like something that might be helpful. So I went and very quickly realized that it was this like missing link that I did not even know I was missing. And very quickly, I started to experience that healing and growth that we reference in our title. And it's been very helpful to me on my faith journey in dealing with all of the difficult feelings that can arise as we navigate the shifts and the changes in relationships and things like that that just come along with that experience. And I'll turn it over to Jana.
Thanks, Dan. So I think my story is not too different from Diane's, having gone through a difficult time in my life that actually I think brought me to my faith journey, faith transition. And I also had experience with this through meditation and other teachers that were helping me explain myself to myself through all of those difficulties. And I think I came to Kristen Neff a little bit into that journey, maybe a couple of years in. But when I started seeing her research and the way she talked about self-compassion, what I recognized was that she was putting language to a lot of what I had intuitively been experiencing and what had been very helpful throughout my own faith journey. And now as I work with clients, and I work with, I've worked with hundreds of clients now in their individual faith journeys, I still find that it is one of the most integral and effective things that I can introduce to people to have them deal with the difficulties that they're experiencing.
Thanks, Deanna. So we just want to briefly tell you what we're going to be doing together today. So when Jana and I talked about this, we really envisioned it originally, pre-COVID, we envisioned this being super interactive, like small groups, individual work, lots of back and forth. So we're going to do our best to maintain that same feel, even though we're not physically in the same space. So like Anne said, we invite you to share your comments and questions throughout, and we'll be looking at our app to read those, and we'll answer them as often and as best we can. So the way it's gonna work is that we're gonna start by talking about self-compassion, an introduction to self-compassion. What is it? Why does it matter? And then we're going to move on to understanding some of the barriers that we experience to accessing self-compassion. You know, we may know that it's a good idea and really want to bring it into our lives, but we're coming up against all these barriers. So just trying to bring some language to that, understand what's going on there. And then we'll spend some time on practice, doing a longer practice, and also just talking about practice in general. And we'll also start with a practice which Jana will lead us in, and then we'll have our Q&A as well at the end. Jana, I can't hear you. I don't know if our...
Thank you. Yeah, oh, no, that was me.
Okay, good.
I muted myself. So if we can go to the next slide.
Yeah.
For this practice, I love poetry as a way to land in my deeper experience and in my body. And so we thought we would share a poem. And what I would love to do is just to ask everyone, if you're comfortable, to just really try to arrive in the space that you're in right now, and arrive in the present, and to really engage not just your brain, but your whole self with what we're going to be presenting here. So if you're comfortable, I would invite you to close your eyes and just pay attention to your breath. Notice the feelings of the breath coming in through the nostrils, filling your lungs, and then pay attention to the sensations as you let that breath go. Just take a couple of deep breaths with me. Just feel yourself in your environment. Feel your seat in your chair, or if you're standing, your feet contacting the ground, and just feel the support of your environment. And then while you're doing this, I'm just going to read this poem. It's called Love After Love by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. And say that again. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine. Give bread, give back your heart to itself. Give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life.
I gotta turn off my camera.
We can also hear you, Anne. Okay, I'm going to do that last little bit again. Give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart, take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Take a few more deep breaths, and then as you're ready, just you can open your eyes and rejoin us. We'll move forward.
Okay. So, thank you, Jana. Feels good to just land. Yeah, exactly. So, we want to start off with a quote by Kristen Neff. Dr. Neff, many of you may have heard of Dr. Neff. She's been the pioneering researcher of self-compassion. Self-compassion and the idea of it has been present in the great spiritual traditions of the world for a long, long time. But it's only been recently, in the last couple of decades, that scholarship and research has been dedicated to the topic, and Kristen Neff has really pioneered that. And then she joined forces with her colleague, Chris Germer, and they founded the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, and then they created a program, the 8-week Mindful Self-Compassion program. So we're really drawing a lot on their research and their knowledge and expertise and that program. So I want to start by reading a quote from Kristen Neff. This is compassion in her words, and you'll actually recognize maybe some of this language from the description of our course I borrowed. Having compassion for yourself means that you honor and accept accept your humanness. Things will not always go the way you want them to. You will encounter frustrations, losses will occur, you will make mistakes, bump up against your limitations, fall short of your ideals. This is the human condition, a reality shared by all of us. The more you open your heart to this reality instead of constantly fighting against it, the more you will be able to feel compassion for yourself and all your fellow humans in the experience of life. And what I really want to draw out of this is the idea of relating to your human experience in a new way. So self-compassion, it's easy to approach it as just another thing to add to your checklist, another to-do, a self-improvement project, but it's really about relating to the experience of being human in a new way, creating an inner conversation, an inner environment that you want to be a part of, a place you want to be, and learning to connect with and embrace the true essence of who you are and really coming home to yourself, which is why we love that first poem so much. That's really what self-compassion is all about, being at home in yourself.
Okay, so I'm just going to share a little bit about kind of an informal way to maybe have a way into self-compassion. I know when I first started this and people talked about just giving yourself self-compassion, it seems so easy, like just, you know, be nice to myself or buoy myself up. But I found this to be a really nice way in to really understand what we're talking about with what does this actually look like to have self-compassion. So I like this informal definition of just treating yourself the way you would treat a close friend who is having a hard time. Now, if you really think about somebody who has been, who is having difficulties in life, has opened up to you about that, who has felt some sort of misfortune, they feel like they have failed, they maybe feel inadequate. Imagine how you would respond to that. Imagine what tone you would use. Imagine what you might say to them. And then imagine times when you yourself have suffered in the same way. And imagine you've had a misfortune or you have failed or you have felt inadequate. And think about the ways that you typically would respond to yourself. If you're like me, those are two very different experiences. So really what the self-compassion is about is being able to take those feelings and those reactions that we would have to someone we really love and admire, and being able to turn those same feelings onto ourselves and to cultivate a kinder, gentler way of dealing with ourselves in all of the frailties and difficulties that life brings to us. And when you're able to start to connect to that, then we can land in a place where we start to ask the question of what do I need right now? And that to me has been a really, really helpful way into thinking about self-compassion.
So we just wanted to touch on some of the benefits of self-compassion. There's tons of research out there now. It was really hard for me to cull this list down to what you see here because it's enormous. So at this point, there are well over 1,000 studies just verifying the mental and physical and emotional benefits of self-compassion. So just to name a few here, more life satisfaction, more self-confidence, more physical health or greater physical health, gratitude, resilience, creativity, and happiness, and less depression, anxiety, less stress, shame, and negative body image. I just want to touch on one study. If you're interested in research, there Kristen Neff has a lot of the studies out there on her website. So you can go there and have a heyday with all the research. It's really fun. So I wanted to touch on one study that I find really compelling that highlights the power of self-compassion to cultivate resilience. So about back in 2015, there was a study that came out where veterans come home from Afghanistan and Iraq, and these are veterans who'd seen combat. Their levels of self-compassion were measured as they came home. And then 9 months later, they followed up with these veterans to see who had developed PTSD. And what they found, I want to just mention two things. One is that they found that self-compassion was a very powerful predictor of whether someone was going to develop PTSD or not. So if somebody had high levels of self-compassion, they were less likely to develop PTSD. And then second, it was a more powerful predictor than the amount of combat that they had seen. So if you had a person who had seen a lot of combat and had high levels of self-compassion, they were less likely to develop PTSD than somebody who had seen a lot of combat, very little combat, and had low levels of self-compassion. So it's really pointing to the reality that it's not only about what stresses we are experiencing, it's about how we're relating to those and how we're relating to ourselves in the midst of those.
So I want to talk a little bit about physiologically what is happening to us when we are noticing a threat. And to kind of explain why self-compassion, why this would be like Diane just talked to us about that study with veterans. So when we are under stress, we have developed, evolution has brought us to a place where our bodies tend to so where we perceive a threatening situation, our brain tends to process a physical threat, which is how we developed. We see emotional threats in the same way. Our bodies experience them in the same way. So if you can imagine a time when we were developing as hunters and gatherers, and this idea of better safe than sorry started to enter our evolutionary process. You know, if you heard something in the bush and you heard a rustle, you were better equipped to survive that situation if you assumed it was a tiger rather than a bunny. So if you can imagine now, anytime our system perceives something as a threat, whether it's an actual tiger or just someone being critical to you or, you know, some disappointment coming to you, our bodies are experiencing this same level of threat. And what happens is our bodies release, it triggers the release of cortisol and adrenaline, our endocrine systems get online, our heart rates increase, our pupils dilate, and really we're going into that fight or flight system where we're just ready to deal with whatever threat is coming to us. So, what this leads us to in today's world, where we are not out fighting tigers all the time, is it leads us to this place of harsh criticism. And what is activated is our lizard brain. It's that first part of our brain that evolved, which is our amygdala. And that's what puts us into that fight or flight. we also have this mammalian care system that we have access to. And what that looks like is when we are soothing our own pain, or when we are having help soothing that pain, we're tapping into that system, that triggers the release of oxytocin, which gives us a greater feeling of well-being and care. And it enhances trust, calm, safety, connectedness, and allows us to feel warmth and compassion that is really hard to feel when we're in our triggered threat system. If you notice, when you're in that, not only is it hard to access compassion for yourself, it's hard to access compassion for others. And this is something that is not automatic in us unless we're in a really calm environment. So what we're trying to do, one of the things we're trying to access with teaching you some tools with self-compassion, is to notice when we're in that threat system, how do we turn on this other care system that can help bring us to a place where we can then calm ourselves and offer compassion to ourselves and others. So now Diane is going to take us through a practice to show us how that would work.
Thanks, Jana. I'm sad that this picture isn't showing up, because it's a very adorable picture of a mother lion with her cub, trying to illustrate, you know, this experience of the caregiving system and what happens. And really, I love how this highlights that self-compassion isn't just a nice idea. There are these real and measurable physical effects that happen in our bodies. So like Jana said, we're going to go through a short practice now called supportive touch, and you get to watch us and you get to be behind in the privacy of your own home, but you can watch us do it. So this is super helpful in really accessing that mammalian caregiving system. Our skin is a super sensitive organ, and there's a lot of research out there about how soothing touch really activates that mammalian caregiving system and our parasympathetic nervous system, and helps us to calm down and feel supported. So it may feel silly to do it to ourselves, but it's super effective. And I love this practice because it's so easy to use all throughout our day, anytime we need it. Okay, so what we're going to do is, once again, we're just going to kind of get settled in our chair. And if it helps you to settle, take a few deep breaths. And then I'm just going to walk you through a series of different hand positions and ways to offer yourself support physically. And you always, always have the freedom to not do something I suggest, to try something different. This is not by any means an exhaustive series. These are just ideas and really an invitation to start playing around with this and seeing what works for you. So let's start with having our hands together like this. And as you go through all of these different positions, just kind of paying attention to, what does it feel like? What comes up for you? Does it feel supportive? You can play around with pressure. Like, does it feel good to have to, you know, give a little squeeze to your hands, or is it better to just like have them lightly resting? And then try switching and doing this with your hands and releasing your fingers. Noticing how that feels. You know, and these are really subtle things, really subtle ways you can offer yourself compassion. Just if you're in a meeting, or, you know, out running an errand at a family event, no one would ever know. Okay, now try putting one hand over your heart. See how that feels. Try putting the other hand on top of the first. And again, playing with pressure. Maybe you like a little bit of pressure. Maybe it feels better to have them just resting lightly. Some people really appreciate having a fist, so you can make a fist and put that on your heart and then put your other hand over it. Kind of notice the difference. Does that feel better to you than having both hands open? And there may be times when you know, maybe now a certain position feels good, but then later you go back to it and you're like, oh, that's not really what I need right now. I need something else. So this is really about paying attention to yourself, your own body, and your own needs. Okay, now let's try putting both hands over our belly. Just a couple more. Try putting one of your hands over your cheek and just kind of cradling your face with your hand. Try bringing the other hand up, seeing how that feels. Just do one more. Try putting one of your hands up on one of your collarbones. Okay. Now just relaxing and transitioning back to the group. And like I said, this is just something to keep working with and seeing what feels good to you, what feels supportive. And really utilizing it as just one of the tools. And what you'll find with self-compassion is there are so many different tools, and there will be certain tools that work really well for you and others that maybe don't work as well, and that's okay.
Okay, so we're gonna transition into the three main elements of self-compassion that are taught by Kristen Neff. And kind of talk about what each of these are and a little bit about what they're not. So the first one is mindfulness. I'm going to start over in the bottom right quadrant here. Mindfulness versus over-identification. So often when we are in a situation where we're feeling upset, we tend to over-identify with the emotions that are coming up for us. If we're really angry, we just feel like that is all of what we are at that moment. And what the research shows is that when we are in that over-identification, we tend to just react. We're in that threat kind of a physiological system. What brings self-compassion is mindfulness. So what that means is that I'm not over-identified with the situation that is happening. I can actually take a step back and notice that I am having an experience of anger right now. That is the experience that has come into my awareness. So it's being aware, being able to take a step back, make my vision a little broader. And once we can do that, I can have the ability to say, wow, you know, I'm feeling really angry right now. This is the experience that has come into my life. And that makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense why that would happen. Gives me a little bit of ability to access that self-compassion and validation for myself. The second is then moving to the left, the common humanity. So one of the things that the research has shown is that a lot of the time when we're under threat, we tend to close in on ourselves. We tend to isolate. We are trying to keep ourselves safe. This makes perfect sense. And when we are in that all by ourselves, it can tend to feel really, really big. And when we're able to, again, take the scope out a little bit into our common humanity, notice that I'm not the only one who's having this experience. There are a lot of people who suffer in this way. It is not just me. It tends to bring an understanding and a calmness, again, to us that we can normalize our struggles and our failures as part of, as Diane said earlier, our common human experience. The third thing is kindness, being really kind to ourselves. And this is a little bit about, you know, the informal definition I gave again of being able to treat ourselves with the same kind of kindness, care, and support that we would offer to another person who is in that situation. We're moving away from this tendency that many of us have of self-judgment. When we're in judgment, that's a clear sign that we are not accessing our self-compassion and our self-kindness. So we are doing something to actively soothe and comfort ourselves and tapping into that idea of what is it that I need right now. So Diane's going to share a few things about with us about what self-compassion is not.
Yeah, I think it's super helpful to when we're for me at least, when I'm learning a new topic, to understand what it's not, when I'm trying to understand more fully what it is. And so we're just going to touch on a couple of things here. So a lot of times, I'll read them first and then I'll go through them each individually. So self-compassion is not demotivating. It's not weakness. It's not selfish. And it's not self-esteem. So the number one reason people cite for not wanting to practice self-compassion is that they're worried that it's going to lead them to complacency or they'll feel demotivated. They won't work towards their goals anymore. They'll be lazy. They'll stop progressing. So this is a real fear for a lot of us. But that's actually not the case at all. In fact, what people find when they practice and what research backs up is that self-compassion is actually a far more effective motivator than self-criticism. And one of the reasons for that is it allows us to create that safe space internally that we talked about earlier that helps us to learn. It's an optimal learning environment. When you don't feel safe, there's a lot of fear there, right? And you don't feel like you can acknowledge failure. And that leads to an inability to integrate our learning as we grow and move forward. So the next one is that self-compassion is not weakness. Again, I think we come by this very honestly. We live in a society where we get a lot of messages about, you know, having a stiff upper lip, pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps, toughing it out. And so we can feel like, you know, offering myself compassion in this way is really a sign of weakness. But study that I mentioned earlier illustrates, it's actually this profound, it provides us profound resilience and isn't weakness at all. And not only does it allow us to be more resilient, but we also find that people who practice self-compassion are much less likely to ruminate and dwell on issues that they're having, because it really widens our angle, our lens, right? Our view of what's happening. And we can see that, we can see it in context rather than really being narrowly focused on the problem that we're experiencing. Next, self-compassion is not selfish. So often we think, you know, I'm going to offer myself compassion. That means I'm thinking about myself. I'm thinking about what I need. That's taking away from my ability to help other people and to be out there in the world doing that type of work. In fact, the opposite is true. When we offer ourselves compassion and meet our own needs, we're much more emotionally available to other people. We spend a lot of time when we're critical of ourselves, really in that, right? In our minds, in the feeling, in the story of it all. But when we are able to practice being mindful, recognizing, naming whatever's coming up for us, seeing it with common humanity, really widening that angle, right? And seeing it in the greater context of the human experience, and then giving ourselves what we need, we're able to move on much more quickly than we otherwise would be able to. And then lastly, self-compassion is not self-esteem. So this is a really interesting one to me, and it's really crucial in understanding self-compassion. So self-esteem, at least as it's taught in American culture, is really all about being above average, right? It's about being superior. And that's rooted in a scarcity mentality. Everybody can't be superior. Everyone cannot be above average. And self-esteem is all about having a positive evaluation of your own self-worth, whereas self-compassion has nothing to do with evaluation at all. It's offering yourself this unconditional love and acceptance because you're having a hard time. And that is rooted in abundance. There is enough of that for everyone all the time. And so it's very different than self-esteem and has a very different effect. And it's not up and down based on whether we feel we're doing well or doing poorly. It's a it can be a constant in our lives.
So, Diane, I'm noticing that we got a question come through that goes very well with this that you're talking about with self-esteem. The question that is being asked is, how do you combat the, but my situation isn't as bad as blank? So, like Diane is saying, I'll take a stab at this, and then Diane, if you have anything to say about this, but that thing you're talking about the comparison, and the self-esteem of wanting to be above everything else, that is a function of this, of that comparison system that our brain does and that our personality wants, that our ego really wants. And so I would just say that it's so common for us to do this, right? I have this thing, and it's really hard for me, but at least I'm not going through XYZ. You know, it's really not an effective way to access any kind of self-compassion. It's taking us out of that that common humanity, recognizing that all pain hurts. All of our experience that bring pain is suffering and is legitimate. It is not just legitimate if it reaches a certain threshold. So that's part of recognizing for ourselves that we deserve to pay attention to our suffering. We deserve to have the experience we're having. And it doesn't matter how that compares to what anyone else has ever gone through or, you know, whatever else you've gone through. Just because I've had a really, really bad trauma at one point in my life does not mean that I will not have lesser sufferings and that it won't be just as hard later on in my life. So even comparing to yourself, all suffering is legitimate. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I will just say that I absolutely feel you. I have the same struggle. Certainly right now, in a pandemic, I'll have a hard moment and I'll think, oh, you know, I immediately start invalidating myself, by comparing, you know, my situation to someone else's who's is vastly harder. Right. If you're looking, you know, if you're measuring, and so I just want to, first of all, normalize it, right? Like Jana said, like, this is very common. This is very normal. And I experience it as well. And I think, you know, Jana put it really well, that it's all valid. And this is really opening ourselves up to this both and type of relationship with life. Like both can be true. It can be true that someone else's situation is more difficult in many ways. And it's also true that our situation is hard and that we deserve love and compassion too. So both can be true. Both are true. And so this is really all about that shift, in how we're relating to life. And the reality is that when I don't give myself what I need, nobody wins. Like that is not helpful to anyone. And then I'd also just say one more thing about this is that this is another way, like when we're experiencing comparative suffering, when we're doing that, it's another opportunity to bring self-compassion in and go, oh, I'm doing it, right? I'm doing that. And recognizing that and offering ourselves compassion, because that's just another part, very natural part of our human experience.
So well said, Diane. It reminds me of the Brené Brown video. If anyone has seen this, it's a video that if you just Google Brené Brown empathy video, it'll come up and you can watch this. It's very short and it's animated. And at one point in it, it's talking about someone who is down in the hole. They're having a difficult time. And she's talking about what empathy is not. And it's the other character is there saying, oh, well, and I can't remember the exact things, but things like, oh, so you're having trouble at your job. Well, at least you have a job. You know, that is exactly what you're doing to yourself when you're saying, but my suffering is not as much as someone else. And it is really not helpful. It's what self-compassion is just like offering empathy to someone else. It's getting down in that, recognizing that we're suffering and having that be okay. And just even saying, I don't know what to do about this, but I'm here for you. And we can learn to do that for ourselves. So if you haven't seen that video, go look at it and you'll see how that relates. So keep the questions coming. We love the interaction. So barriers to self-compassion. So when we were talking about this, there are some that we especially feel within our Mormon upbringing. We just want to note that these are very human. This is not just a Mormon problem. This is a human problem. We are just going to be talking specifically about how our brand of bringing this home to ourselves, how this shows up. And this is not meant to be an exhaustive list. This is just a sampling of what particularly in our culture has taught us, has brought us to a place where it makes self-compassion really necessary as we move through, especially as we move through a faith transition. I see a lot of this in my office with people who come in a lot of suffering. So first of all, just to acknowledge that there is a huge stigma with faith development within our faith and within most faiths. If anyone is familiar with Fowler's stages of faith, and if you're not, there's a lot out there about it. I did a podcast on Listen, Learn, and Love, episode 144. If anyone's interested, I go more into that. But most religion resides in a place that, and our faith definitely does this, where we're comfortable in a place of just listening to authority, of conformity, of imagining there's one way to do faith, and that's just to believe, and keep moving up that ladder of belief until we are certain. And when someone starts to do a really deep dive within themselves, which necessitates questioning and doubts, then it becomes so difficult for both us and for the people around us. So because of this stigma of we don't understand what's happening when someone goes into that phase, then it creates a lot of questioning and mistrust and feeling misunderstood that really turns on this hypercritical system of self and judging yourself. I've seen a lot of people worrying about, am I making the wrong choice here? What am I doing? And yet not being able to find their way back to the way they used to believe that was more comfortable for themselves and everyone else around them. So this is something that really, really requires some self-compassion and some really focused work to move through. The egocentrism, we don't mean by that just thinking about yourself. That's kind of how what I think of when I think of someone's egocentric. The egocentrism we're talking about here is more from an idea of being caught up in the personality and the ego, kind of like the self-esteem we were just talking about. It's getting caught up in, you know, the things that our ego wants, which is to be separate and superior. And that brings in the comparison, that brings in judgment again. We have a theology about a fallen nature that because of what happened in the Garden of Eden, now we are fallen. We can't help but make mistakes, but that makes us unacceptable to God. That makes us, we can't even be in God's presence. And so it can, to certain personality types, feel like this hamster wheel of trying to become okay, to fight for our own worthiness and okayness constantly. And that if we let go for a minute, we're going to get swept down the stream and we're going to be put so far behind where now we have to claw our way back to being okay again. A lot of this analysis could be coming from the fact that I'm a one on the Enneagram that is really, really hard on myself all the time. I'm a super harsh inner critic. So that could be informed. These things can be informed by that. There's this idea of perfectionism within the church, and not just personal perfectionism, but there is an idea that we have. Again, this is human, but our Mormon flavor of this is that the church, the leaders, are perfect. We are being directed by God, and so everything they do is exactly the way God wants it. What that sets us up for is that when something is not working for me, I automatically think I'm broken. I automatically think it's got to be me, because it's not the system, it's not the leader, it's me. And that brings a lot of self-doubt that can bring in a lot of that criticism and harshness to oneself. Judgment and worthiness. I mean, judgment is kind of embedded in each one of these, actually, as I'm thinking about it. It comes down to this, we are constantly judging where we are on the path. We talk about our bishops being common judges in Israel. We're all preparing for that judgment day. It is all about a self-analysis at all times. Worthiness, I mean, I don't know if I even need to say much about that. Like, it is so embedded in, we have regular worthiness interviews, our highest rights that we're all supposed to be striving for to be in the temple requires us to be worthy. And we've defined very interesting ways to attest to our worthiness, as if worthiness is something that can be lost, as if worthiness is not just something that we are born with because we are human, because we are children of God, because we are part of this amazing creation. So I think we tend to talk about worthiness in really some really unhealthy ways. We are in an achievement society. This definitely also goes beyond just Mormonism. Our American society, which is all about achievement. It's all about success and outward shows of that success and what that means, and getting status and money and security, and that has leaked into the church. And it's probably more obvious to people from other countries even that have a slightly different view of things than it is to us here in America. We're so in the soup. But that, again, leads us to all of the self-evaluation. Spiritual bypassing and hyperpositivity tend to kind of go hand in hand, and so I'll just kind of explain briefly what each of those means. I mean, I'm realizing I could do a 3-day seminar on probably each one of these things and how it affects us, but we'll go through this quickly. Spiritual bypassing is when we are using our religion to just feel good, that we imagine that is what good religion is all about, is just bringing peace. And this sets us up for, first of all, avoiding the very things, the difficulties in our life that are really actually going to bring us growth and transformation. And hyperpositivity is what you fall into while you're trying to spiritually bypass. So I'm having a difficult time. A couple of the mechanisms we use, we spiritually bypass by saying, oh, you know, my anger, that's Satan. That's the adversary. I'm going to put that off on somebody else. So I don't have to actually deal with it. And if I'm just really positive, if I just put a positive spin on this, if I just look at what's good in my life, then those things will go away. And the truth is that those things typically don't go away. We can mask them. We can avoid them for a certain period of time. But they will always come back, and they leak out in other ways. But we really have a culture of this. I mean, how many of us have heard the over and over the story of President Gordon B. Hinckley on his mission and having difficulties in expressing those, and the message was just forget yourself and go to work. We have this idea of just pull up your bootstraps. And I will say this is not entirely a horrible thing, but if it's all we're doing and we're not paying attention to ourselves, to our inner world, to what is really difficult for us, we're not learning the lesson, we're not growing, and we're not gaining more empathy that we can draw on for ourselves and others. So that's a quick view of all of those. Do you have anything to add, Diane?
Thanks, Jana. Well, I would invite anyone, if you want to add to our comment and question section, anything else that you've experienced, we'd love to have that and read it out. I think, yeah, just touching back on what you were saying about the hyperpositivity, it really is, I just kept wanting to go like this. Because self-compassion is, it allows us to widen our view. I know I've said that a couple times already, but I that is the gift. So it's not, oh, now I'm just going to focus on all the negative and the hard things. It's that I'm going to allow, there's room for it all. it's making space, right? Making space, an internal world and environment that can hold whatever is.
Yeah. And if I can just add to that, one of the big barriers, I think, to really accessing self-compassion with this is a very human trait, very human, which is, and I'm going to do this in the words of one of my favorite poets, David White. I heard him use this phrase and I loved it. It is a deep reluctance to be left to ourselves. And I think what he means by that is, think about the resistance that so many of us feel when we think about just putting down the phone, turning off the TV, shutting down all of the distractions and just being with ourselves and our experience. I think that is a really, really hard thing to do. And starting to notice that, like, what is that reluctance to be left to ourselves? But in that silence is where we really start to meet ourselves. It's where we really start to understand the depths of what is going on in our lives and in our souls. And so I just thought I'd bring that up, that is a really common experience. It's a really common experience when people start to engage in this deeper inner life where really the wellspring of self-compassion comes. We do have a few more questions.
Yeah, let's read them.
Okay. So one of them is about how can we teach teenage girls to have self-compassion?
Do you have any thoughts
on that? Yeah.
This is actually my work. So I work for Girls Empowerment Network, which is specifically working with girls in grades 3rd through 12, but lots of teens there. And so we teach self-compassion in much the same way we're teaching it now. We do exercises and activities. We're about to do another practice with all of you. So we do practices. We help them to understand. So just helping girls understand, you know, what's happening here. I think our understanding our nervous system and our brain and all of these things. Why is this happening? What's coming up and what does it mean? And what can I do? And I think probably the number one way is by modeling. So as we're doing it, as we're doing that work, it changes us. It just does. They will notice that and sense that. And we can also just talk very openly about it too and be totally transparent about what we're doing and what's happening for us. So those are my thoughts. What about you, Jana?
Yeah, I love that. And I think with that modeling, I think one of the things that I've noticed is one of the most powerful tools that we can learn to use with ourselves and with our teenage daughters and with anybody else we're working with is validation. So validation for some reason scares us. And what I mean by validation is not like, I think what scares us about validation is that we fear that we are going to be condoning things that we don't really want to condone with ourselves or with other people. But really what validation says, you don't have to agree to validate. All validation says is that makes perfect sense. I hear that that is your experience. And you came by that honestly. Life brought you to that place where we were brought by that honestly. So I think when our teenage daughters are coming to us, or our sons, or anyone else, and they are telling us something that they're struggling with, it's having that be our very first response before we do anything else is just to say, wow, that sounds really hard, and I can understand why that's hard for you, and tell me more, and get curious. And when we make that safe space for others, when we teach others how to lean into the hard places, without abandoning themselves or invading themselves, then that's where healing can start to happen. So that would be one tip I would give.
Yeah. And I love that you brought up curiosity, because that's so foundational to this. It's just really bringing a curiosity to our own experiences and the experiences of other people. Because we're so quick to judge, right? To judge our own experiences and the experiences of others. Yeah.
We want to take one more question before we move on.
Yes, and then I actually received another question via text because it was too long in WOPA. Okay. So we can maybe we'll save that one for the end. But let's do this the next one that's on
the
roadmap.
The question is, what are strategies you have for having self-compassion for those narratives and things that continue to come up for us when we think we have it worked through that and it pops up again?
Yes, I hear
that.
Yes.
I can start if you'd like.
No, you can go ahead. You start.
Okay. So one thing is that this idea that we've worked through something and that that should be the end. So one thing is just to adjust our expectations of what life is. I think Diane mentioned this is not necessarily self-compassion. The goal of self-compassion, the goal of mindfulness, the goal of meditation, the goal of all of this is not to stop feeling the difficulty. It's to offer us something when the difficulty inevitably comes. And leaning into the idea that life is a vulnerable thing. There is no 100% safety from anything. So the very fact that we normalize that it's going to come up again and again and again and again, and self-compassion may not stop that from happening. But what we're teaching here and the tools that we're teaching will help you each time it does. And the experience will be a little less jarring each time. As we just sink into the idea of the problem is not that I'm having a problem. The problem is that I don't want to have a problem. The problem is that I'm done working through this. I'm just tired. But the rest comes from just resting into the vulnerability and knowing that as it comes up, we're equipped to deal with it. Any other thoughts, Diane?
I want to go all of that. And just again, normalizing that experience, right? Like we have these really well-worn neural pathways. So, you know, if you're 25, if you're 30, if you're 35, if you're 40, chances are you've been thinking this way, right? This became a strategy, a coping strategy for you. And so it's totally natural that it would keep coming up. And so bringing self-compassion to that experience and seeing it in the context of the greater human experience and that this is what it means to be human, right? Like this is it. And like Jana said, it may not shift. It may keep coming up. But what I've found personally for me is as I just offer compassion to myself as I'm having hard times, what ends up happening for me or what's happened over time is usually like I just loosen my grip on the thing, right? And so, you know, there are sometimes things where I'm like, oh, why am I still struggling with this? Like this needs to go away. And so that's what I'm doing, right? And so if I can hold the struggle lightly like this, then when it's ready, it'll go. It'll go. And so I feel like, again, it's this new way of relating to the experience of being human. I'll just keep saying that. Okay.
I love that. It's taking the tug of rope, putting down the rope and just looking at it rather than continuing the struggle. I love that.
Yeah. So thank you so much for these questions. We really appreciate them. Okay. So we're going to do a practice now. This again, I wanted to share practices that were really practical, that are things that you can take on the go. You could use this in a more formal way when you're doing a sitting meditation. You can also do it just on the go, really short. You could draw it out. It has a lot of flexibility. And I also wanted to share this because I use it every single day, usually many, many times a day. So it's something that for me has been hugely helpful. And I also find it really helpful because it takes us through the three components of self-compassion and helps us to bring the each of those to whatever we're experiencing. So we're just going to go through this quickly, but like I said, it's something that you can draw out. You could do it as a journaling exercise, even right now, if you prefer to journal this rather than, kind of do a sitting meditation, that's completely fine too. So whatever works for you, please do that. This will be about 5 minutes. Okay, so once again, let's get kind of settled. It might help to have, if you're sitting in a chair, to have your feet flat on the ground. And just take a couple of deep breaths. If that feels good to you. The point is to be settling. So if deep breathing doesn't help you settle, you can choose another way to settle. You could offer yourself the soothing touch that we used earlier. You could listen to the sounds around you. Point is just to settle into to this moment, really, really drop into your body. So what we want to do right now in this practice is we want to call up a little bit of suffering. So, and just at the outset, I'll say, you, for this activity, you want to find something that is on a scale of 1 to 10, about a 4 or a 5. So we don't want anything overwhelming, but something that elicits a little bit of an emotional response for you. So think of something you're experiencing right now. It could be in relation to your faith journey, maybe a hard conversation that you've had, maybe a narrative that keeps coming up for you, or it could be something totally unrelated, something with your job, anything that, or something related to the pandemic, whatever it is, just bringing to mind an experience that's challenging for you. And then once you have that, just fleshing it out a little bit. So who's involved, what was said, what wasn't said, and how does it feel in your body? So can you recognize kind of places in your body where you feel that? So maybe there's tension in your chest or tightness in your throat. Maybe you feel it in your belly. Just trying to localize it. Now, once you have it, a really vivid picture and feeling of this situation, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through all the components of self-compassion. So first, mindfulness. So in this exercise, what that'll look like is saying to yourself something that validates or acknowledges the difficulty. So this could be, this is a moment of suffering. This is a moment of suffering. It could be, this is really hard. It could just be naming that the actual feeling you're experiencing, grief, shame. And as always, you have complete freedom and permission to play around here and find exactly what phrase is going to work for you and resonate for you. We're validating it. We're bringing mindful awareness to the fact that something's hard right now. And then the next thing we're going to do is we're going to move into common humanity. And again, find a phrase that really resonates for you and helps you widen your view. So it could be, this is part of the human experience. It could be, I'm not alone. Just playing around with different phrases and really paying attention to how it feels in your body when you say that. Is that what you need to hear? Just being curious and open. And then the last one is offering ourselves some kindness. So what do I need right now? What do I need to hear? And it might be helpful to think, what would I say to a good friend who was experiencing this? Or it might be helpful just to ask yourself, what do I need to hear? There are different ways to access this. Finding a question that works for you and helps you get to the heart of what you really need right now. And so you may say something to yourself, simply like, I love you. I'm here for you. I'm so sorry you're going through this right now. This is really hard. It could be phrased more like a hope or a wish. May I accept myself exactly as I am. May I be kind to myself. Again, just finding something that works for you. And there isn't any one right way to feel here. We're just trying to get curious about our experience and offer ourselves compassion through these three components. And whatever you're experiencing as you do that is completely okay. Okay, just taking a couple of deep breaths if that feels nourishing for you. Just allowing yourself to be exactly as you are. No expectations. And then when you're ready, just transitioning back to the group. Just quickly, I wanted to share one personal story about using this practice that relates to my faith journey. So a couple of years ago, I was on the phone with a close friend, and I was being vulnerable, sharing something that was hard for me, and in relation to my the questioning that I was doing and all the grappling with my own faith system, my own belief system. So I shared, and she just didn't want to talk about it. She just closed right up, didn't acknowledge what I said. It was very clear that she did not want to talk about it and moved on. And it was really hard for me in that moment. And we got off the phone, and I just felt bad. I felt really lonely. I felt really sad. I felt really misunderstood. I felt myself going into storytelling mode, and I was like, nobody understands me, and I'm alone, and she's probably assuming all of these things and thinking all of these things. And then I remembered self-compassion, and I was in my car, and so I went through this self-compassion break, and by the end, I felt much more grounded. I still felt sad, but I wasn't caught up in the story. And, I felt like I needed to call her back. So I called her back, and I just said, "Hey, I noticed when I brought this thing up, this is how you reacted. You seemed like you really didn't want to talk about it. So I was just wondering, this was what that felt like for you." And, she said, "Well, I actually really agree with what you said, and I feel the same way, but I'm experiencing a lot of depression right now. I'm really struggling with depression. And so I can't, this is too much. I can't go there. I can't talk about it." And so I would have never known that had I stayed caught up in my story. And I think I want to bring self-compassion to that too. That's normal to get caught up in our story, right? So not just self-compassion isn't just another opportunity to be hard on ourselves and go, "Oh, I didn't offer myself compassion, and now all these bad things happen." But really just recognizing the power of self-compassion. And that in that moment, it had a very powerful and real effect, and changed the trajectory of that situation. Okay, so
we have one more question.
Oh yeah,
and I'm trying to be mindful of the time as well. Yes. So maybe we can talk about where we want to go from here. But maybe we could take this question, and it's right now it's the only one in the queue. So if more questions come through, we maybe want to skip some of the things we have coming, right?
Okay.
Or
and I have
if
that
we
one
don't,
in my text.
Yes. Too, so maybe if we want to. Take some time for those questions. Maybe do one of them now. And what do you think?
Yeah. How about this? How about is it okay to skip the clip that we had?
Absolutely.
That's okay. Okay. And then what if I just touch on Backdraft?
Okay.
And then
we can focus on that.
And then we can just do the questions. What do you think?
That sounds great. And if we have questions coming in, great. If we don't, then we can do the clip.
Perfect. Okay. So one thing we just wanted to mention is my graphics are struggling. Sorry, everyone. So this picture of a firefighter is illustrating backdraft, which is something that we can experience when we start to offer ourselves compassion. So this, so backdraft, you may be familiar with this phenomenon of when there's a fire and all of the available oxygen has been used up. As soon as more oxygen is available, maybe it's like through a broken window or a door, then there's an explosion, right? And so Chris Germer coined this term to explain what can happen when we start offering ourselves compassion. So sometimes we feel worse. And we say love reveals everything unlike itself. And sometimes what happens is as we're offering ourselves unconditional love, we discover, and this is something Chris always says, we discover the conditions under which we were not loved. And so self-compassion, so we just want to make sure you're aware that that can happen as you start to offer yourselves compassion. And you may already be doing this and experiencing this and be very familiar with it. But just normalizing this and giving some words to it, because it can be really jarring. But it's not happening because, like, self-compassion is not making that happen. It's creating an environment where these things are, there's a safety, there's a new safety. And so it, things that need to heal, things that need to be addressed, things we need to look at, have space to come up. And so this is something we may experience, and I definitely experience it. And then lastly, just wanted to point you to this little figure, which I think is super helpful in allowing us to kind of track our own internal experience and regulate ourselves. So we call these the zones of learning. So the comfort zone, the stretch zone, and the panic zone. So the stretch zone is where we're experiencing learning and growth. And then we can move sometimes into a panic zone or an overwhelm zone. So just making sure you're aware of that and understanding what that feels like in your body. So sometimes it might look like hyperarousal, like you're feeling really agitated, or maybe it's hypoarousal. Maybe you suddenly get like kind of out of it and like really exhausted. There are lots of different ways this can show up, but just making sure you're aware that that can happen and being able to track that yourself and then bring yourself back into the comfort zone. And so just closing, giving yourself permission to stop the practice and do something else, get some fresh air, take a rest, whatever it is, have a conversation with a friend, whatever it is. And so just having these tools to kind of understand our own experience and track. Do you want to add anything to that, Jana?
Yep, I think that's great. Okay. It's that being mindful of not abandoning or invading ourselves. And being mindful when you're with other people and holding their suffering, not to invade or abandon. That is where we heal, is in that center zone of just pushing just enough, into it.
Yeah, thank you. Do you think we should stop sharing the screen right now, or?
Sure.
What do you think, while we do our questions? Okay.
Sure.
Okay, and then we'll-
Do you want to go ahead and do the one that you got in the text?
Yep, okay. I'm gonna stop share. Okay. And then we'll go back if we have time. We have some resources that we'll put up at the very end, so you can take a screenshot if you want to look at those. But there are lots of great resources out there that we want to point you to if you're interested. Okay, here's the question. My main sources of anxiety and struggle right now seem extremely connected to the environment around me. I have 4 young kids at home. When things are messy and cluttered and chaotic, I start to shut down mentally and emotionally. I'm really working on separating my mood and actions with the state of my dishes, but it's just so hard. When I get on top of a project or tackle a big cleaning job, I feel so much better, but often the process is fraught with real inner angst, swearing, blaming my family in my head, feeling like no one understands how hard I have it, etc. What does self-compassion look like in this scenario, and how can I feel more calm during the process?
Great question. It's a really good one.
Yeah. Do you want to start
that one?
Off?
I feel that right here, yeah. Right? Ooh, yeah. The struggle is real. Do you have any starting thoughts?
I think so. This may not feel very helpful, but it really just reminds me of the need for self-compassion at all stages of this process, right? Like just self-compassion for this reality that you're experiencing, right? Four little kids at home running all over. I have three, by the way. So like, yeah, it's wild, right? And so, you know, it's easy for me to look at all of these spiritual teachers that I love and go, oh my goodness, like if I could just do a 2-week retreat, or if I could just meditate for an hour a day, that would be amazing. That would be so much better, right, than what I'm experiencing now. And I think for me, thinking of one thing that helps me is thinking about life as my practice. So not this is a thing I have to write a checklist thing and it looks a certain way, right? It needs it for it to be valid for me to be practicing self-compassion the right way. It has to look like this. So really just like letting go of that and allowing my life just to be what it is and to integrate practices that make sense. And they may be practices that no one's ever told me about. They're just things that if I have the mindset of like, okay, I really want to practice self-compassion. This is what my life looks like. Maybe it's okay. While I am folding the laundry, I'm just like feeling the fabric, or like while I'm, you know, I mean, you can work little things into your life. And I think also just like allowing everything to belong. So the anger, the frustration, not judging ourselves for that, because this is the last thing I'll say. I know I'm going on a little bit, but there's a Buddhist parable that I love about the arrows, the first and the second arrow. So the first arrow is like, that's just life, right? The car breaks down. I become sick. I lose my job, whatever it is, right? That's the first arrow. The second arrow comes from how we relate to that experience. So much of our struggle and our suffering comes from that second arrow and the way we're relating to our experience. And so again, this is all about just bringing a lot of curiosity to that. Well, how am I relating to this? What is hard about this for me? Why, you know, how could I think about this in another way? And just being really curious and trusting your own inner wisdom. Like I think is that, like, you know, I think for me, it's very easy for me to be like, oh, someone else is going to know what I need to do, right? Like, oh, I'll just, like, if I read enough blog posts, if I listen to enough podcasts, if I go to enough workshops, then I'm going to get the answer for my life. And yes, all that stuff is good. I love it all. I do it all. But really, like, trusting yourself and that you actually know what you need, and you can listen to all these people and you can gather tools, but you know. And so just trusting that too. Okay.
Yeah. I love that. You'll notice I punted to Diane first, because honestly, I really did. I really did feel that. The struggle is real. So I just want to say, I feel the difficulty of that and the difficulty of bringing self-compassion into those moments, because, you know, we have so many expectations of ourselves. We just do. And, you know, this is, again, it's a both and thing. Of course, we don't want to just give up on all expectations and just say, well, you know what, I'm fine with my world being chaos. I'm just going to give up. I think that tends to be our one thing. I'm in the struggle, or I'm just going to give up. But I do think there are expectations on us as mothers, and that we have to have everything clean and pristine. I mean, my mom seemed to do it, you know, why can't I do it? And I would just want to validate, first of all, we are not living in our mother's world and our grandmother's world. we are living in a different world with different expectations of ourselves. And we're doing ourselves a disservice by not kind of keeping up with that. So first of all, just maybe noticing, bringing awareness to the messages that you're getting of what you should be and challenging those. Challenge those ideas of what is it that I should be, and tap into what Diane was talking about, that inner wisdom of what is it I really want for myself. Once we get to that conversation, it's a little easier to start saying, okay, are there other, this is where we can start getting creative. Are there other options? Are there other options for me to get the dishes done? Can I solicit more help from my family to be doing some things? Can I let go of some of those expectations? Can we be okay with things being a little chaotic and messy while we have young children? I mean, I don't personally know many who are able to hold that all together. And if so, they are giving up things in their lives that I was not willing to give up during that time of my life. So being kind to yourself. I mean, just a concrete example, if you're looking at a sink full of dishes and it's time for bed and you are so tired and you don't want to do the dishes, take a moment. This is a practice, a self-compassion practice you can do, is just take a moment and become aware of what's going on. And ask yourself the real question, what is most nourishing to me right now, rest or getting this clean? And if your answer is getting it clean, then that's coming from a different place than this driven I must. It's coming from a place where you made a conscious choice. And then you can engage in that activity with just feeling the water over your skin and engage in it as a way of doing something kind for yourself so that you have a little more order as you start the day the next day. If your answer is, you know what? No, what I really need is rest. Then just feel that. Feel that and give yourself the gift. And then when you see the dishes the next morning, you can know you made a conscious choice about it. So I just think bringing a little intentionality to those kinds of situations can go a long way. Okay, should we look, let's see.
I don't think we have any more.
We had one more.
That's what I thought, but I don't see it anymore.
Okay, so I'll read it. Worthiness. In Mormon culture, we may be told we aren't worthy because of the sin committed. How do we teach ourselves that we really are still worthy, for instance, even during repentance process? Great question. Shall I take a stab?
Yes, please.
Okay. Worthiness is an insidious thing. And I'm just going to share a quick anecdote about worthiness in our culture. It was when I was a Relief Society teacher at the time. And I was asking what I thought was a really simple question at the beginning of the lesson. I asked, what gives us worthiness? What makes us worthy? And I got so many answers about accomplishments. This is what I have, this degree, I have this family, I have this in my life, I have these activities, I have a neighbor who does things for me. I have, you know, they were all these external signposts of worthiness, right? And I was astounded. And it actually, I asked a question, well, if imagine someone who has had a really rough upbringing, just really didn't have parents who were connected or cared, and they ended up in prison, and they ended up there alone, and they don't have accomplishments, they don't have family, they don't have all of the things that people had mentioned. Does that person have worth? And we really had to dig deep. It took 10 or 15 minutes into the lesson for people to say, you know what, we have worth because we are the seeds of Godhood. We are divine. And at the very least, the potential for the divine. Like, this is part of our nature, our divine nature. We talk about this in young women. So I don't know what the men do, but we do, right? And I just think that's indicative of what we do. And embedded in the question, right, is we're not feeling worthy if we have done certain things. And one of the things that I think is very compassionate is to just recognize your own inherent worth that cannot be taken away. And I really do think this is even at the heart of our own theology. We just culturally talk about worthiness in a way that I just think is just robs us of that vision. So I think part of this is just recognizing that narrative and challenging the narrative that somehow that has affected your worthiness, that somehow something you could do could affect your worthiness, because truly, messiness, mistakes, I can't emphasize this enough, it is part of the process of living. It is the choice we made, it's the choice Eve made, leaving the Garden of Eden, yet somehow we are all trying to scramble back to the garden. Mistakes are not something that hits our worthiness. Mistakes are the path. They're not things to be avoided along the path. They are the path. It is where we gain our wisdom. It is where we gain our experience. So to me, having a recognition of that is one big step. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I agree with everything Jana said. And I would just say that, you know, when you have received a message repeatedly, you know, it's there, right? And so just, having grace and compassion for yourself, because, it's not your fault. It's not your fault that you feel that way. And that's also true of the people who taught it to you. It's not their fault either. And this gets very like, right? Because we want to go, whose fault is this? Who did this? You know, and so for me, this sense of common humanity, is really expanding my view to include all the seen and unseen forces at play in any given situation. Obviously, most of which I can't even fathom, but just the exercise of widening my view to try to include those, and understand and that things are not neat and tidy, in the way that we so want them to be, that I so want them to be, you know? And so I think, you know, not being hard on yourself about struggling with questions around your own worthiness. I mean, I just totally relate to that. I was telling Jana when we were preparing this, that I remember an experience when I was in college of an interview with the bishop where he said to me, you know, your mistakes are causing pain to the Savior. Like, he's bleeding because of like what you're doing. And, you know, we get that message in a lot of different ways. And so it's a powerful message. And so like Jana said, just like questioning that and bringing curiosity to it. Where is that coming from? Where is it originated? Where did it originate? And really moving out of the kind of ability to blame ourselves or other people for that.
Yeah, and I would just add the distinction that Brené Brown makes in her research between guilt and shame. Start noticing the narratives, because guilt tells you I've done something that didn't serve me. And I did something wrong. And shame says I am wrong. So if we can just notice when we're using that shame energy toward ourselves and transmute it into, it's a mindfulness thing, right? Stepping back and saying, what I did not serve me. I would like to do something different. But when we're in shame, it actually keeps us from being able to make that move that we really want for ourselves. So that can be helpful as well. I think we're pretty much out of time.
I was thinking I might share my screen just so people can screenshot the resources if they want to.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And if people want to, while you're doing that, if people want to continue the conversation, please continue to, I'll be looking at these and answering some questions that come along. And if I think, Diane, you put our contact information on this sheet as well. So if you want to continue conversations beyond this, I would love to. Invite me to a meetup. Talk to me. Send me a message through the app.
Yes, absolutely. Agree with all of that. So if you'd like to screenshot these resources, these are just a few. And then this is our contact information. Like Jana said, we would love to continue the conversation, whether it's on the app or elsewhere. Please reach out. And if you don't have anything necessarily that you want to talk about right now, please feel free to just send us your contact information if you want to stay up to date with like things we're offering online or workshops or various things. We'd love to include you in that. So thank you. Everyone, do you want to
read? All right.
I think we can.
Yeah, our time is up. Thank you very much. This was an amazing session. I'd like to thank everybody for attending and for supporting Sunstone. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you in the next session.
Thanks, everyone.
Take a screenshot of this poem.
Yes, so good.
It's our wishes to you.